are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 9th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Deputy Editor of New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells, on the latest IPCC report and how the end of the world has become old news. Meanwhile, Nikki Haley resigns. No one knows why. Brett Kavanaugh's regime begins on the Supreme Court as Blasey Ford still in hiding. Sympathies, of course, to Brett Kavanaugh. Massive data breach shutters Google Plus. And Trump's enormous money laundering and tax scams revealed yet again. Question remains, why has it taken so long? Bless you. Meanwhile, the Trump administration pretending to be concerned about a missing Saudi journalist. And Florida braces for Hurricane Michael. It is the last day to register in 15 states in the country. If somehow you are not registered to vote at this point, don't be an idiot. Go register to vote. I hope that was gentle enough. Taylor Swift has broken conservative hearts and surged voter registration. Yeah. And Bernie on a massive midterm tour, 21 states, all this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday. Thank you for the kind emails about the interview yesterday. I'm glad folks liked it. Carol Anderson is a fascinating writer. And I think, you know, particularly in this era, again, you know, I said this yesterday, but there's two dynamics to Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, which is not to say that he's the only person like this, but he is the final piece in the puzzle. And that is basically diminishing the rights of, I don't want to say the marginalized, because it's actually sort of a little bit larger segment of the population than that, but of a significant number of, or, you know, broadly speaking, the, you know, half the country in one form or another, and then increasing the rights of corporations. It comes up even today in the context of our the interview we'll do about this IPCC report. Brett Kavanaugh, and I'll touch on this with David Wallace Wells, but Brett Kavanaugh wrote the opinion in a case as to the EPA's ability to regulate hydrofluorocarbons, I think it is. In the context of global warming. And understand, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but this is really important. This is where the Chevron doctrine comes in. When Congress writes a statute, they don't necessarily know the science behind, and I'm talking in the context of the EPA. They don't necessarily know the science behind it. Maybe science doesn't even know all the science behind it yet. But broadly, it says the EPA can regulate any substance it deems to have implications on the health of individuals. I'm painting with a broad brush, but this is just to illustrate. Now, maybe at the time that they're writing this law, they don't know that hydrofluorocarbons are implicated in global warming. And at the time the statute's written, those chemicals are not a threat to human life, human existence. So the agency needs to have some latitude to make those determinations, to be aware of new science, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Brett Kavanaugh said, no, that's an overreach. That was the Chevron doctrine, incidentally, that the courts are to defer to the agency's expertise. Brett Kavanaugh said, no, that case was appealed from the D.C. Circuit, the second most important court in the land, and the Supreme Court rejected a bid to review that Kavanaugh-authored appeals court ruling just this morning. So now that needs four justices to certify, something to be taken a look. It's unclear to me who looked at it. It doesn't necessarily mean that all four liberal justices rejected it, or they may have just decided, like, we don't want this to come up right now. But this is just an indication of where we're headed. This is just the beginning, folks, and we'll talk more about that as we go. In the meantime, we've lost another one, folks. Nikki Haley has resigned from the Trump administration as UN ambassador, and it is unclear at this point why she has. There is reporting that this is an indication that Pompeo and Bolton have won the day. It may mean she's not belligerent enough at the UN. Hard to believe. She disagreed with them in regards to how many refugees we should let into this country. I certainly don't want to make it seem like she's an unreasonable individual. It's just that she's in a room with some full-on lunatics, and so it makes her look slightly better. Although the ease in which she lies and the weirdness in which she expresses, she identifies herself, is a little bit strange. Here she is speaking to the press in announcing her resignation, sitting next to Donald Trump.
It has been an honor of a lifetime. I said I am such a lucky girl to have been able to lead the state that raised me.
Pause it. Now, I find that if I were to refer to a 45-some-odd-year-old woman who is the ambassador to the United Nations as a girl.
She's a lucky girl.
I mean, honestly, this is just, it's just bizarre.
That's what Daddy Trump likes. She's being folksy.
I guess so.
Come sit on my lap.
Exactly. Is it really? Are you really too much? I guess in the wake of what went on with Kavanaugh, you don't want to get too pushy, right? Call yourself, refer to yourself as a woman. I mean, can you imagine if a 45-year-old man was resigning from the UN and saying, I have always found myself to be such a lucky boy?
You know what? Actually, I can.
Really?
Are you familiar with the large sons concept, Sam?
I am not.
Large adult sons. So it's basically like the Trump boys. They're adult men, but they don't have any sense of responsibility. So Kavanaugh was being a bit of a large son.
I see.
It's kind of the same.
Did he
principle.
Say, we'll go to his acceptance speech and just say, I'm one of the luckiest boys in the world.
It's kind of the same principle by which a 12-year-old black kid is a terrifying criminal who deserves to be killed on sight, while a 60-year-old white man is just, you know, he's just a boy.
I just don't
can't
think
blame him for anything.
That may be the case that in his mind, but I just don't think that they would refer to themselves as a boy. But continue.
It has been an honor of a lifetime. I said I am such a lucky girl to have been able to lead the state that raised me. and to serve a country I love so very much has really been a blessing, and I want to thank you for that. But I'm most excited. Look at the 2 years. Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do.
Yeah. About that, I'm not sure if the ambassador to the UN was at the UN, I guess it was about a week and a half ago, because if she was, she might have seen this.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
Yes, you can see the teeming respect that they have for our country now. Oh, and also, you may have heard that an American resident, a Saudi journalist, was just killed in an Istanbul embassy, Saudi embassy, because they have so much respect for us. And then, of course, the Chinese basically kidnapped the head of Interpol because of the tremendous respect that in which we're held. And then around the country, of course, I'm sure you've seen the polling where if you measure that as a sign of respect, it is at an all-time low. But the bottom line is this country is our capacity to exercise soft power so been so greatly diminished. And that is really scary because our hard power, we still are quite confident about it. And that's where we'll end up going when we don't get our way.
Yeah, the world respects us the way you respect a five-year-old who's gotten its hands on a gun, you know, just like a really cool guy that you respect.
Right, exactly, of course. So Nikki Haley leaving. Some people are speculating that perhaps she's anticipating Lindsey Graham going to Attorney General and then getting appointed Senator from South Carolina, serving for 6 years, perhaps, and then running for president in 2024. Who knows? But I don't think we're going to be so lucky for her to move on to a corporate job. We may not be the lucky boys and girls that she is. And we may see her in the future in our politics. All right. I should tell you this, too. One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. Yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. Quip was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. Look, folks, the key to an electric toothbrush, here's the dirty little secret. The key to an electric toothbrush is to use it every day. That's what I love about Quip. It has sensitive sonic vibrations, gentle on your sensitive gums. It's got the built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch front top, back top, front top, bottom, back bottom. That's the way you go, folks. I mean, you can really do it any, it doesn't matter. But here's the key. It doesn't require a clunky charger. It runs for 3 months on one charge, comes with a multi-use cover that mounts to your mirror for a less cluttered sink space. So here's the bottom line. It's not sitting in your room charging and you got to bring it to the bathroom. You can travel with it so you don't get out of the habit of using it. And that's the key. You got to use your electric toothbrush. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association. When I was in Vegas, what did I have with me? My Quip. Because you can't possibly fit another electric toothbrush in there. And it's stylish. Quip has backed over, it's been backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. It starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack with a free, free with a Quip electric toothbrush. Every 3 months, they send you a new toothbrush, Ed, which is what you got to do. It's the other thing. You don't want to be using a bunch of mush on the end of your toothbrush. Matt. That's your first refill pack free at GetQuip. That's GetQuip.com/majority. Do it now. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, the deputy editor of New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells, on the latest IPCC report.
A viver pelos mares, mergulhando profundo em recifes e corais. Minha missão nesse mundo é pesquisar animais, mergulhando no escuro. Agora que eu cheguei aqui, nada vai me tentar a fazer desistir. Eu não posso dormir com você nos meus sonhos. Já conheço seu doce, seu olhar tão medonho. E é sem ar que eu fico. Há muito tempo eu fico.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the deputy editor of New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells, on, well, on the latest IPCC report. But let's just start by with this, David. I mean, I think a lot of people, very aware of your piece from last year, in July of 2017, The Uninhabitable Earth. I think there's even a Wikipedia page about your piece.
Yeah, so flattering.
And, well, it's important, and I want to talk about some subsequent pieces you've written about sort of the lack of attention it gets, but you basically walked through, I think it was, close to 10, maybe more, sort of elements, nine, I think it was, of what we can anticipate sometime in the future, not that far off. And apparently, as of a couple of days ago, it was reported that it's going to be a lot quicker than we had anticipated. But go through some of these sort of like, just to go over your piece just a little bit. Some of those elements which we can anticipate, that range from doomsday, when you talk about the and then heat death and so on. Like, what are the ones that you think Americans are going to have to deal with the most?
Well, the first thing I should say is that piece was sort of systematically focused on worst case scenarios. So it's a bit scarier than I think we're likely to see over the next couple of decades. But that's not to say that any of these are not worth worrying about. They're all absolutely terrifying. And in fact, which we can talk about later, I think considerably scarier than even the new IPCC report suggests. I think the public has been generally sort of trained by scientists and science journalists over the last couple of decades to really think about climate change in terms of sea level rise. And the truth is that the impacts are so much bigger than that. There's literally not a person on the Earth in 2050 who won't be affected by climate change in one form or another. And it's, we all live in climate, and the fact that it's being deformed will deform all of our lives too. So, there are a lot of elements of that. There's, direct heat effects, which are not going to hit so hard in the U.S., but in other parts of the world, so that by 2050, many of the biggest cities in India will be literally lethally hot in the summer. You won't be able to go outside and walk around without dying. There are huge agricultural impacts. So for every degree of warming, grain yields, grain is the biggest component of the human diet, grain yields decline by between 10 and 20%. So if we're talking about a world that's 3 or 4 degrees warmer, we could have, 30 to 80% less grain to feed the world, and the world will have more people to eat that grain by the end of the century. But the things that to me sort of sum up the whole problem are ones that we don't really talk about much at all, which are only beginning to be studied by the academics who work on this stuff, and those are the economic impacts and the effects on conflict. So the researchers who are really looking at this closely now think that if we don't do anything about climate change, if we stay on the track that we're on now, the emissions track that we're on now, by the end of the 21st century, global GDP will be more than 30% lower than it would be without climate change. There will be, in terms of conflict, the relationship with war is a little complicated. It has to do with a lot of these other impacts. It has to do with, droughts that produce famines, and has to do with public health issues and all that kind of stuff. But in general, a world that's, say, 3 or 4 degrees warmer will have as much as half again as many wars as we have today. And those are two of the metrics I think people haven't really thought much about, but they also serve to sort of encompass all of the other problems. They the costs of extreme weather are reflected in those economic projections, and the costs of wildfires are encapsulated in those projections. So I think we're starting to wake up to some of the impacts beyond sea level rise, but we haven't really thought about just how dramatic those impacts are going
to
be.
The irony, of course, in terms of the U.S., to the extent that there's been any agency that has looked at the concept of destabilization around the globe as a function of climate change is the Pentagon, right? I mean,
they're the only ones, as far as I
last remember, I mean, I don't know if they're allowed to even say this anymore, frankly, but that climate change was one of the greatest threats to national security.
Yeah, and that is, that has so many different components to it. I mean, just to start with, literally every Navy base in the world will be underwater in a couple of decades. So that entire branch of the military will at the very least have to completely rebuild its infrastructure from scratch. That's also true of a lot of Air Force bases. But beyond that, the whole map of the world is going to change. The Arctic is opening up. There are already tankers that are now traveling through the Arctic. That territory is going to be disputed. And particularly if we see a kind of revived conflict with Russia, which we seem likely to see over the next decade or two, there is a natural sort of IRL, component to that, and that we're going to be fighting over control of the Arctic. Our conflict with China, which is likely to also get worse over the next couple of decades, is going to play out in part over the South China Sea, where there are a number of islands, some of which the U.S. currently controls or has sort of military relationships with, which are going to sink, and where the Chinese are already building a number of artificial islands, which are designed, among other things, to endure in a world with dramatic sea level rise. On top of all that, it's, I guess, up for debate exactly how much the U.S. will continue to be the world's policeman in 20 or 30 or 50 years. But to the extent that the military is doing the planning for that, they're planning for a world with, as I said, as many as half again as many wars. A lot of people think that the conflicts that we've seen over the last couple of decades in the Middle East have a lot to do with warming. That's the part of the world that's been hit hardest by the warming that's already gone on. And there are some really incredible studies showing, down to like the month that heat waves and droughts and other climate shocks are responsible for a huge portion of the ethnic strife in the Middle East. So we're already starting to see a world that is made more violent and rivalrous by climate change. But as the Pentagon knows, that's going to get worse,
right,
as the planet gets warmer.
Some have speculated or theorized that in Syria, climate change impacted grain production, and the Assad had sold off a bunch of their stores of grain, and the prices of the grain also implicated, you know, some of the turmoil there. But I mean, putting that aside for a moment, let's turn to the IPCC. This latest update, give us a sense of what that update was. I mean, it sort of dropped like a bomb. And characterize it for us, and then let's talk about what was going on behind that.
Yeah, well, I think the best way to actually understand it is to back up a little bit to the Paris Accords, which were signed in 2016, and which established this target for the world that we should stay below 2 degrees Celsius of warming. So, you know, it may be a little confusing to your listeners. A lot of the American coverage of this deals with temperatures in Fahrenheit, but the rest of the world is always talking about Celsius and then rounder numbers. So it's the numbers that I tend to use. So the Paris Accords established this target of 2 degrees, and that was actually a bit controversial. As recently as a decade or so before, the scientific community had understood 2 degrees to be basically the threshold of catastrophe. It's about where most scientists understand the tipping point for Arctic melt to be, so that they think that if we get past 2 degrees, that all of the ice in the Arctic will eventually melt, and there's no way that we'll be able to get it back. That'll take a really, really long time, probably over centuries, but if we don't want seas that are 200 feet higher, we'll need to pull up short of 2 degrees. Now, right after the Paris Accords were signed, a number of representatives from much smaller nations came out and said, you know, these impacts are going to be hitting us much, much sooner than 2 degrees, and we really need to think about ways of halting warming before that. The president of the Marshall Islands called 2 degrees of warming genocide. And that started a conversation both among the scientists who are working on this report and generally in the scientific community. There's been a lot more research just over the last couple of years about this particular question, like what would the world look like at 1.5 degrees? What would the world look like at 2 degrees? And this report is basically the IPCC's version of that. So they are saying that, first of all, 1.5 degrees, which they say we're going to get to by about 2040, is considerably worse than the same body had said it was before, that the impacts on food production and food stability and security is going to be much worse. Sea level is going to be worse. The effect on climate refugees is going to be much higher. But also that as the president of the Marshall Islands sort of predicted, and the people like him predicted in 2016, that the climate impacts of a 2 degree warmer world are so much higher that really we absolutely, absolutely need to halt warming well before 2 degrees if we want to avoid a truly catastrophic climate scenario. Now
I should just say, just so that people can picture this, 2 degrees of Celsius, if I'm not mistaken, is about 3.5, maybe 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So just so that people get a sense of like what we're talking about, like, you know, none of us can feel that, right? So we're just talking about the implications of it around the world. As an average, we will feel it on a daily basis.
Well, and it's the main impacts are not on the average day. It's that they dramatically expand the possibility for extreme events. So this past summer, we had this basically unprecedented global heat wave, hundreds of people dying all across the world in a heat wave that lasted a few weeks, you know, as in the Middle East, in northern Russia, in Canada, in the U.S., in Japan, and literally that had never happened before in human history. And quite soon, that kind of summer will be a completely normal average summer, probably within a couple of decades. But to get back to the IPCC report for a second, they're basically saying 2 degrees is going to be a climate catastrophe. They say that it will endanger the lives of hundreds of millions of people through a variety of these impacts. And we absolutely, absolutely have to, you know, do everything we can, mobilize at the scale that we mobilized before World War II globally to make sure that we get somewhere close to 1.5 degrees of warming. Now, the crazy thing about this, I mean, this report has been received with incredible alarm. The world is really freaking out about it. The crazy thing is that, like, basically, they admit that 1.5 degrees of warming is an impossible goal. The truth is that 2 degrees of warming, which is what they're saying is the absolute catastrophe that we must avoid, is more or less also an impossible goal. So I mentioned earlier the Paris Accords, they established this target of 2 degrees, but the actual pledges in that agreement, you know, the each country made a pledge, we're going to cut our emissions by this amount. All of those pledges add up to a world that by 2100 is about 3.4 degrees warmer. So we haven't even made the commitments equivalent to get us below 3 degrees, let alone 2 degrees. And on top of that, no major industrialized country in the world is on track to meet those commitments. So at the moment, we're blithely going forward on a track that is going to take us north of 4 degrees by 2100, which is literally twice as bad as the scenario that the IPCC is now calling so catastrophic that we must do absolutely everything in our power to avoid it. So while this report is in its way incredibly, incredibly alarming and is very sort of conscientiously raising the alarm with the public, the truth is that the bigger picture is much, much scarier than even this report suggests.
Insofar as we don't even have the imagination, never mind the ability to execute. We haven't even imagined the plan yet to execute, never mind executing the plan that we already have.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a kind of an interesting little case study in what motivates human action. We have most of the technology that we need to completely green the economy if we wanted to. For the first time ever in most of the world or much of the world, you know, green energy sources are cheaper than dirty energy sources. We know about a lot of agricultural solutions that could make our agriculture much more efficient. Agriculture is a really underappreciated contributor to climate change. It's about, I think, about 35 or 40% of the global emissions. We're just not doing any of that. And if you think that, as most scientists will tell you, we need to completely green out our energy infrastructure and make our global agricultural carbon neutral by, even the conservative scientists would say, 2050. Many others who I trust a bit more would say by 2040 in order to avoid 3 degrees or higher of warming. That's a really, really big problem. In New York, we just finished a minor extension of a single subway line that, depending on how you count, took 50 years to build. And we're talking about rebuilding the entire energy infrastructure of the planet in about 30 years. We have those tools. It's not like solar is a fantasy technology, but we actually need to put it into practice. And that's what a lot of these activists mean when they say what we need is a mobilization on the scale of World War II. It needs to be the absolute number one priority for all governments of the world and much of the industry of the world. And at the moment, while there are more and more people worrying about climate change, we're very far from it being anybody's top priority.
And when we talk about that in terms of World War II, I mean, there was more or less, if not explicit, like an implicit nationalization of a lot of the manufacturing capacity of, you know, the world's, you know, by the world's
industry.
Governments,
yeah,
of totally. Industry by the world's governments, where it's basically like, you know, you want to make cars, but guess what? You're making tanks. And that's sort of what we're talking about, right? I mean, like, basically, we need our government in the context of the United States to nationalize our energy production and infrastructure.
Well, that's one of the reasons that green energy has gotten so much cheaper is that there was in the Obama years a lot of tax subsidy and you know, other kind of VC investments that the government made into the development of green energy, which as a result proceeded much more quickly than even its biggest boosters would have predicted. I mean, we're much farther along on that curve than people thought we'd be a decade ago. And that's really great news. But actually, you know, the way I look at it, the U.S. is important. I mean, it's at the moment, it's the world's second biggest emitter. But it's also the only country in the world, the only big country in the world that's whose emissions are going down already. And the major, major driver of future climate change is going to be China, India, and to a lesser extent, sub-Saharan Africa, where there's sort of scheduled to be a massive population boom over the next century. And China, you know, it's interesting, since Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords, China has sort of seized the mantle of rhetorical leadership on climate in the world. I think they see a kind of geopolitical opportunity there. And they've also done a lot of really great stuff on climate. They've been especially focused on getting, you know, cleaning up their air pollution, because that also poses a huge public health issue for them. But when we talk about, you know, climate change generally, I think that a lot of Americans, even a lot of sort of Western Europeans, have a mistaken idea that what we're dealing with is the legacy of several centuries of industrial activity, so tracing it back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, you know, more than half of the carbon that humanity has emitted in the entire history of the planet has been emitted since Al Gore published his first book on climate, like 25 years ago. And almost all of that activity has to do with the industrialization of the developing world, China most especially. So when you hear from people like Steven Pinker, and you know, there are a lot of kind of optimists out there who say, like, you know, the last 25 years, the era of globalization, it's pulled so many people out of poverty, it's almost eliminated infant mortality, and that's totally true. I mean, you look at these graphs, and the world is much, much, much better than most of us in the West really appreciate, because the standard of living in the developing world has climbed so rapidly. But almost all of that, almost all of those gains were bought by this process of industrialization that has also brought us to the kind of brink of planetary catastrophe. So going forward, a huge amount depends on those countries. I mean, China especially, India secondly, and then the countries of sub-Saharan Africa as a sort of third order interest. And the U.S. is important in the way that the U.S. is, you know, still global economic leader, global geopolitical leader, and can really set agenda and bully people into signing up to commitments they might not otherwise want to make. But in terms of what we're doing within our borders, the truth is we're much less consequential in terms of what's going to happen than some of these other countries, which I think is a little bit actually of an uncomfortable feeling for a lot of Americans who both want to feel like, you know, their story is the global story, but also want to be able to villainize the American right and the fossil fuel companies, who are, to be totally clear, like, obvious villains in this story. They've done, you know, climate denial has been absolutely horrible, but it really is only a very partial explanation for where we are, and it has almost nothing to do with, like, how scary things are going to get.
All right. Well, that is both scary and then sort of with an added layer of terrifying, because because I want to talk, you wrote a piece, you know, I guess it was, I can't remember, maybe at the beginning of the year, about, you know, how did the end of the world become old news? I guess that was over the summer, and maybe just a couple months ago. And the idea that, you know, I mean, it's certainly, I know on this program we talk about climate change far less since November 8th of 2016 than we did prior to that, because there's a real sense of, like, doesn't matter. I mean, not that climate change doesn't matter, but no matter how much we talk about it, there is nothing we're going to do to move a Republican-controlled Congress and a Republican president. And now, and we should maybe touch on this briefly too, a Republican or right wing controlled Supreme Court with Brett Kavanaugh coming on, who is, you know, to the extent that one could put up roadblocks to anything positive happening, that, you know, in terms of the apparatus that already exists, he is, you know, sort of the poster child for that. But if
I think it's just, sorry to cut you off, but it's you know, he's his positions on on Roe have been talked about a lot, but actually he's considerably more conservative on the question of federal regulation than he is on the question of on the question of choice.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why, frankly, the right was so jazzed to have him. Roe is, sort of the shiny object there for them. But I think from a business and the corporate perspective, his philosophy that government regulation is almost in and of itself illegitimate is, I think, very attractive to these corporations. But so we're twice removed here, right? Like, it doesn't matter. We could put 5 million people on the streets tomorrow in New York and the Republican president, the Republican Congress would just be like, yeah, whatever, enjoy your blue state. But on top of that, even if we were to move forward, we would be we would still be hoping that our soft power could sort of somehow influence these other countries. I mean, what do we do about that? I mean, I was rereading your piece on these disasters and looking at, like, I think it was New Delhi that you said would be inhabitable within, several decades because of the heat. And I'm thinking to myself, well, we made Iraq. I mean, like, we made Iraq inhabitable for at least several hundred thousand people that we killed. And we created 4 million refugees for over the course of, 5 or 6 years. No one see, I mean, it wasn't. People cared, but not that many, like not enough to really fundamentally change our government. We were directly responsible for that. Never mind. We're just, in the bleachers watching it, New Delhi becomes inhabitable. What's the psychology behind this? I mean, what do we do?
It's a really complicated question to answer. I think, personally, I return always to politics. I think that, we have what I think of as a kind of a delusion in the well-off liberal West that we can make a difference with our consumption choices, that if we, if we drive electric cars and if we fly less and if we, eat less red meat, that, on some level we can sort of address the problem that way. In my mind, like, politics is such a moral multiplier here that's like the only way that we're going to get to the kind of, where we're talking about the World War II analogy, the only way we're going to get to that level of transformation is by applying political pressure to our governments and around the world. And, I think that's, one reason the midterms are so important. It's another reason that, 2020 is going to be so important. But looking at the bigger global picture is even scarier. I mean, the obstacles to change on this front in the U.S. are real, but globally, what we're seeing over the last decade is a retreat from the very kinds of institutions and sort of networks of cooperation that would be our only hope for true global action. So you have all across the world, nativist movements, nationalistic movements, right-wing leaders who are really, really focused on securing the well-being of their own country, not thinking about the globe as one community that needs to deal with this genuinely existential threat. And that's really, really alarming. It's only continuing further. I mean, the election results in Brazil earlier this week, right, or over the weekend were, they got one more round to go, but it seems quite clear that Bolsonaro is going to win, and that's just another step forward in this. We built right after World War II, after many, many millennia of human conflict, we built a kind of a network of cooperation. The UN is a big part of that, but the EU is another feature of it. We had globalization itself, which is, obviously a kind of complicated economic system that has produced many losers, but even so was really an effort for the world to be working together and moving towards shared interests. And over the last decade, that's really changed. It's interesting you said, we talk a lot less about climate change since November 2016. If you look at the public opinion polls, actually the peak of awareness and anxiety about climate change was in 2007 in the U.S., and that was in part, I think, because of Katrina, and in part because of the Al Gore movie and Inconvenient Truth. But that interest was like leveled off completely. I mean, it was cut down by the financial crisis. People started worrying much more about the state of the world when they worried about the state of the world in those terms, in financial terms. And there's a kind of a bait and switch there too, because, you know, we've sort of understood for about a generation or so. I've understood. I'm, you know, essentially a neoliberal technocratic kind of person, and I had the idea that like the public would only accept action on climate change if it came for free or if it was going to offer economic opportunity. And a lot of the messaging around climate adaptation is sort of focused on those notes, saying like, oh, look at all the green jobs we're creating. We're now at a place where we see that the economic costs for not acting are going to be so much bigger than the economic costs of acting. It's almost like you don't think of making an investment in the stock market as a cost, because you expect that over time that you'll be, you know, drawing money out of that investment. And it's, you know, it's getting to the point where it seems almost as clear about climate. There was a report a few months ago that said that if we were to successfully, aggressively act on climate, the world would save $26 trillion by just 2030. I think the number in the IPCC report is $50 trillion by that same year. And that's just, you know, that's just two decades away. So,
but isn't the problem with that calculus that's not how the world works? I mean, I'm not even talking about human psychology in that, like, oh, if I spend a couple of bucks on my car now and change the oil, I won't have to deal with the engine seizing up, you know, down the road. I'm talking about we don't, you know, in the same way that we perceive our economy as doing well, if the GDP is hitting a certain number and the stock market is doing a certain, that's indicative of some people doing well, right? Like, isn't the problem we have when I talk about nationalizing, it's not because we need to marshal these forces. It's because we need to constrain the forces that are preventing us from acting, right? Because the problem is not that it's going to cost all of us too much money relative to what we would save if we do that. It's that it's going to cost some people who have
the powerful people.
Yes. Yeah. Outsized power in our politics. It's going to cost them more.
Yeah. I mean, namely, I guess, like the fossil fuel businesses. But
of
in general, anybody who has sort of entrenched economic power. I think the sort of transformation, the revolution that the economic revolution that's really necessary is bound to upend many of those sort of power hierarchies, and the people at the top of them don't want
like,
that to happen.
Does that implicate, like, I mean, you self-identify as a neoliberal insofar as that you're hoping that the market is going to solve this and that the sort of like market calculations. But when you see the, I mean, for someone like yourself who is so acutely aware of the sort of train that's, you know, barreling towards us as we're sitting on the tracks, like, does that implicate your perspective on, you know, sort of that broader question? Because it seems to me that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, just as an example, Brett Kavanaugh is on the Supreme Court because there's a lot of people out there are hoping he's going to overturn Roe v. Wade. He may or may not. They may do other things that will inhibit a woman's right to choose. But at the end of the day, the reason why the real push behind him, the power behind him, was his perspective on limiting government's ability to regulate corporations. Like, do we, you know, if that is the successful recipe to address, you know, what an agenda, do we need something like that on the nominal center left? In other words, like, do we do this as a bank shot? Because obviously climate change is not motivating people enough. Do we make it about something else so that we get a regime in there that will address climate change, right? Because if the problem is entrenched power of moneyed interests, do we go for, let's just say John Doe, who is going to get rid of student debt, let's say, because ideologically, that person's also going to maybe nationalize our power structure.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think that there are a lot of different paths forward. And my own perspective is that, like, we don't just need to focus on one at the expense of others. But I completely agree with you that the problem is beyond, at the moment, at least, beyond the market's power to solve, and that combined with 2008, we're already seeing, you know, climate change and the financial crisis both have generated a huge amount of skepticism towards unregulated market power. I think that's very valuable on its own, but I also think it's especially useful in thinking about how we might mobilize action on climate. The question you raised about the rhetorical play to be made here. I mean, I think it's for me, it's less about finding someone who is, you know, running on student debt relief, and more about what things about climate change can we imagine and put into play that have much more emotional salience for voters than, say, sea level rise. And I actually think that there are a number of really important ones that have basically not been played by climate activists to this point. The first one is the one I mentioned earlier, which is about the economic impact. I mean, if we're really looking at a world that is 30% less rich, because has 30% less growth over the rest of the century because of climate change, that's twice as big an impact as the Great Depression, and it's permanent. That's huge. Like, that is, you know, economic suffering beyond the scale that any of us can imagine. It's 8 times as bad as the Great Recession was, and we see how much that scrambled American politics, geopolitics. So I think that, like, putting people, you know, putting the economic numbers in front of people much more aggressively, I think, is really important, because it'll hit them in their own, you know, they can see it hitting them in their own wallets and in the society as a whole. I mean,
but can you, though? I mean, I don't mean to, like, you know, but, like, you know, that to me seems so abstract, like the idea that down the road we're going to lose $1 trillion or $1 billion, doesn't even matter, you know, a gazillion in economic activity. Like, is there really a way for the average American to sort of put that in their wallet, like, as opposed to something that is, like, literally affects their wallet?
It's interesting. I mean, personally, I think yes, and it connects to something we were talking about before, which is that, you know, when I said that I'm sort of temperamentally a neoliberal, what I really meant is, like, I came of age in the 90s. I feel like in so many different ways, I believe in my core, in ways that my brain maybe now doubts, that, like, the world is going to get better, that economic growth produces well-being and happiness, and that, like, history is moving in one direction towards more prosperity and health for all. And I think that that basic intuition about the world is dramatically threatened by climate change. Right. And whether or not the average American can say, well, if this happens and this happens, my bank account will be this much smaller. If you imagine, you know, a permanent Great Recession, I think that just about everybody can really understand it's not just exactly how they and their family may bet, but the entire outlook of the country and indeed the planet will have changed away from, you know, the idea that your children will be better off than you are and will be living more abundant, prosperous lives than you did, to one in which the past actually looks sunnier than the future. And that is so dramatic a transformation of perspective. I don't think we've really started to process it, but that is the bargain that's being offered by climate change. I would say one other thing, totally separate from the economic case, is public health. There is an enormous public health interest in stopping climate change. So at the moment, 9 million people are killed every year just from the pollution that comes out of burning fossil fuels. It's called small particulate pollution. 9 million people. And some scientists recently did a study where they, you know, in exactly the benchmarks being used by this IPCC report, looked at the difference between world's public health at 1.5 degrees and the world's public health at 2 degrees. And they found that just based on this one public health issue, just based on the small particulate pollution that comes out of fossil fuel burning, a world that is 2 degrees warmer would have 150 million more deaths than a world that is 1.5 degrees warmer. So that's 25 Holocausts. You know, to go back to what I was saying earlier, like, we have no chance of getting to 2 degrees, right. So it's going to be considerably worse than that. But the public health imperative, I think, is actually quite strong. That's the reason that China actually has moved so aggressively on climate change over the last few years, is that they were dealing with a lot of these public health impacts quite directly.
Right, because their government's going to have to pay for it. I mean, they understand the implications of their of it on their government. Go ahead.
And the public, you know, it's not just deaths. I mean, there are there are huge impacts just on the amount of carbon in the atmosphere on cognitive functioning. So, you know, in cities with a lot of carbon pollution, test score results fall by 10 or 15%, which is really dramatic. I saw a study recently that the effect from car exhaust on premature birth and low birth weight in babies is so strong that in areas where they just introduced EasyPass and therefore the cars moved more quickly through the toll and distributed less exhaust in the community, that low birth rate and premature birth fell by double digits in those neighborhoods. So there are all of these sort of public health correlates that I think people would at least be open to getting agitated about, getting activated by, in a way that they find the prospect of, say, sea level or distant cost to agricultural yields quite hard to wrap their minds around. If they know that, like, you know, the average lifespan of their children is going to be cut by several years because of the amount of pollution in the atmosphere, I actually do think that is a quite strong case for cutting that pollution. And if we cut all that pollution, we will, you know, in so doing, solve climate change. Now, the problem with that is that at the moment, all of the pollution that's in the atmosphere is suppressing global temperatures by about 1 degree. It's called aerosol pollution. All of the shit that we've put into the atmosphere over the last 150 years, it's floating up there and it's reflecting sunlight back towards the sun, which means that the planet is not as warm as it really should be if it was unpolluted. So if we solve the public health problem, if we eliminated all of the pollution in the atmosphere, we would be saving these 9 million lives every year and having all of these other beneficial impacts on public health. But the planet would immediately get 1 degree warmer, which means that we'd already be more than 2 degrees warmer than the pre-industrial average. We'd be already past, again, this threshold that the IPCC was just saying this week is absolutely unacceptable. In some true sense, like with a true state of global warming on the planet, we're actually already north of 2 degrees. It's just that we have this weird, backhanded, pollution thing that is happening to suppress global temperatures so that we think we're only at 1.1 degrees. We're living as though we're only at 1.1 degrees, but the sort of true global warming impact is north of 2 degrees already.
Wow, that's encouraging. If we're successful in saving lives, we're going to end up costing lives on some level.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I got to say, like, I'm a thousand flowers bloom type of guy in terms of ideas. I'm starting to think though that it's the implications of global warming just are too abstract for people as a political motivator. It feels like to me, but we'll see. I should have given folks like a little bit of a warning before we did this.
Well, I would just say about that. I mean, I think that the world is starting to wake up to the issue. I think that with all of the extreme weather we've seen, with the wildfires, with the heat waves, with all the hurricanes, we have another hurricane bearing down on Florida just this week, which is crazy. It could be possibly a Category 4 or Category 5 storm. We haven't even really heard about it. That the world is waking up to the effects of warming and starting to see that it is something other than just sea level rise. But the problem is that we don't have that much time.
Let me ask you this
earlier,
as a last question. to what extent, I mean, because the Republican Party, as far as I know, is the only major political party in the world that believes that global climate change is not real. I mean, as a tenet of their party. To what extent, if the Republican Party, you know, and obviously this is, I'm asking you to speculate wildly here, but if the United States was not inhibited from being a leader in this, like, you know, I mean, and Obama goes out and signs the Paris Accords, obviously completely insufficient. But if there was no political cost whatsoever to this, if the entire country was on board in the same way that maybe a small, Indonesian island was, I mean, what do you think the difference would be in the world?
I don't think it would be much. I mean, you know, as I said before, I think the main drivers of this are, just to take China as an example, China is an authoritarian regime. They do not have any of these political considerations. And while they're moving much faster than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago on climate, they're still moving way too slow. That is because the main...
Do you think an unencumbered United States would have been able to make it move quicker?
I think to some degree, but I think that, you know, the economic trade-offs are really the thing that is that have slowed action on this. Right. And you know, there was a really interesting study that came out a couple of weeks ago that compared the amount that climate change would cost particular countries over the coming decades with how much each of those countries was responsible for warming. And the U.S. actually came surprisingly high on the list of countries that were going to be affected economically. They had the second highest economic cost of climate change. And we are in this weird kind of karmic balance where actually just as our share of the of responsibility is exactly the same as our share of the climate burden that we'll be bearing. India is by far the worst on this metric. They have their share of climate suffering is four times higher than their share of climate responsibility, and they're the country in the world that's going to be hit hardest by climate change. And China is in the reverse situation. China is at the moment they are four times more responsible for climate change than they are, going to be seeing impacts themselves. Right. So the economic incentives in China are actually running in the opposite direction that we'd want them to run. They can theoretically pollute more, and those costs will be
borne by other
mostly
people.
By other. Yeah, and that's the real problem, is that generally we haven't developed a system where we're all in this together, and so particular countries have an incentive to slow walk their own commitments, do less than they need to, because fossil fuel is cheap growth. But if we all do that, we're really fucked. I mean, and there needs to be, you know, one body, one coalition that addresses this totally head on. I think that's really the lost opportunity from American leadership. But I don't think that we'd be much farther along right now, and I don't think that we'd be facing a different set of dilemmas than we do now. It's really, what are the Chinese going to do? What are the Indians going to do? And what are countries like Nigeria and Kenya going to do as their populations like double and triple over the next couple decades?
David Wallace Wells, thank you so much. really appreciate talking to you on it. It's fascinating, but also wildly depressing. But thank you. I appreciate the time today.
Anytime. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. Boo-doop. Say that again.
The world will end not with a bang, but a boo-doop.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean,
just kidding. No, it won't.
I am less hopeful that talking about the implications of climate change are going to bring about any major political change in this country, and more encouraged that maybe a United States that is more aggressive couldn't convince or provide some incentives for other countries. But I'm increasingly, you know, starting to believe that, you know, the best way to solve climate change is to look for an issue set that, somebody who has a platform of dealing with climate change shares. In other words, you know, backdoor, because it's just, you can tell me on one hand that like 30, 40 years from now, everybody's going to have less money in their pocket. Or you could tell me, hey, I'm going to put more money in your pocket. I'm going to vote for the person who's going to put more money in my pocket. And if they end up dealing with climate change, great. But I want somebody who's going to put more money in my pocket right now. Well, I'm being a little bit overbroad, but I'm saying I want direct benefit now. Not, it's too abstract for you to say you've got to avoid, some type of disadvantage 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road.
Well, there's always been a sector of capital that's very short-sighted, right? They care more about whatever benefit the market gets in the short term, which is one more reason the Democrats are actually the ones saving capitalism, right? Because you can't have capitalism if we're all dead.
I guess that's true. I mean, I guess China is also. I don't know.
Nothing like under what political formation could we persuade the whole world to adopt the strict climate standards that we've adopted in a magical land where Bernie Sanders is president and still have capitalist growth?
But that, I mean, I don't think there is one, but you could call, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess if you want to call, China as, operating under a capitalist system, I mean, I think perhaps
it's
on some level.
Capitalism.
Yeah. I mean, but the, I just don't know that the answer, at least in the context of, is, I don't know that talking about it in those terms is any more effective than talking about it in the terms that I think like growth is going to be less or it's going to cost us more. I mean, from a capitalist perspective, here is a guy who has a capitalist perspective on that saying that it makes total sense to avoid climate change. And that's still not compelling, even within the context of a capitalist system, because the problem is not that we're in. The problem is not that. According to his calculations, it's not that it's capitalism per se, because from a capitalist perspective, it's going to cost more to not address climate change than to address it.
Well,
the problem is that we have a disequilibrium of power in two different ways. One, at least in the context of this country, that there are people who have political power that is outsized and are preventing it. But also, the bottom line is that China is going to externalize its costs.
Well, I think you've hit on one of the very important contradictions that exists within capitalism, which is that if you believe in Marx's theory of how value is created, it only comes from human labor and resource extraction. And capitalism has to have infinite growth in order to function. And you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. And it's almost feels a little bit mean for the industrialized countries of the West who had their industrial age based on the environment as an infinite free gift to then turn around and tell developing countries of the world that they can't do that same thing.
Well, I mean, that may be the case, but that doesn't seem to be really the biggest problem. I mean, India is going to pay a lot more than they're going to get out of this system. China is going to get a lot more than they're going to pay out of the system. I mean, that seems to be sort of what is problematic. At least the U.S. is aligned. It's going to pay for what it there's going to be no free dance cards, essentially, for the states anyways.
Yeah.
But all right. Well, that's why we have a fun half, folks.
God.
So that little palate cleanser. Just a reminder, this show relies on your support. Oh, God. Ugh. What a horrible week. It's only Tuesday. This show relies on your support for us to do this every day. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And as our way of saying thank you, We give you extra content every day so that if you want to avoid something that is super bleak, you can just skip right through to the fun half where we just, you know, make fun of people and loosen up. So join the majorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. We're sitting here right now. I'm staring right at our 5-pound bag of Majority Report blend that we keep in the office. You can do the same in your office or your home. 5-pound bag. You don't have to get a 5-pound bag. You get a 1-pound bag and get a bunch of different other flavors if you want. Tonight is the Michael Brooks Show. Michael is sick, but it'll be interesting to see if he shows up for his own program tonight. My guess is probably, because hangovers don't necessarily last that long. Who's the guest? Do you know who's the guest is tonight?
I have not looked up the sheet yet.
All right, there you go.
Alex Preen, I think, is in.
Alex Preen? Okay. So it's Alex Preen. So check out the Michael Brooks Show this evening. You can listen to it after the fact on iTunes, but you can watch it on YouTube at our YouTube channel. And the Antifada.
Yeah, so we did something a little bit different this week on the Antifada. Our friend Jacob Blumenfeld was in town defending his dissertation. He is now a PhD. So we had him on.
Wow.
And he happens to be an expert on the German egoist communist philosopher Max Stirner. He has a book coming out with Zero Books about him. We'd also been wanting to get Dr. Bones on the show from the Guillotine podcast, and he's also really into Stirner. So we sort of hosted a Socratic dialogue between Drs. Bones and Blumenfeld about Max Stirner and anarchism and radical egoism and all that good stuff.
There you go.
I did not know anything about it beforehand. So if you don't know anything about it, that's fine. And now I do know something about it. So check it out if you want to learn about
folks.
That very crazy thing.
And Matt, literary hangover?
Yeah, we did Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Conservatism.
To
yeah, we actually take a clip from this show, from the zero-sum debate.
Did you check on the licensing for that? I mean, what the...
Well, you can talk to my First Amendment lawyers.
Who are your First Amendment lawyers?
Well, that's... You'll have to talk to my lawyers about that.
Wow.
And
I got to talk to your lawyers to find out who your lawyers are.
Exactly.
All right. Very. It's well done. You stay very insulated. You don't have to deal with any of that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
I don't even know who they are.
So, okay. So, you review the Reactionary Mind. It's not really a review, but
no, we just discuss it, play a few clips from it, play a few clips from Corey Robin, discussing it at Harvard. And yeah, it's good. It's sort of, if you want to know why everything seems so hopeless right now, it's because conservatives have won everything. And Corey Robin explains that's why conservatism is sort of incoherent and cruel.
There you go. All right, folks, quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will be right back with the fun half.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance.
Ooh.
coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Two.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.